So we've been going through the book of Exodus. We've been going through the liberation of the Israelites from the Egyptians. They were in slavery in Egypt, and God is delivering them from their slavery and their bondage. And last week what we went over is we went over the Passover celebration, the origins of it. And we talked about how the Israelites, on the 10th plague of Egypt, Egypt had 10 plagues that God delivered to them in order to get them to let the Israelites go. And on the 10th plague, he killed the firstborn child in every household. And the Israelites had to do a certain ritual. They had to do a certain ceremony where they would sacrifice a lamb, and then they would put that blood on the doorpost. And if they did that, God would pass over their homes and not take their firstborn child. And we saw last week that this was a beautiful picture of the cross, about how Jesus sets us free from what we have coming to us, from our sin and our death that we owe to God. And what's happened now is that basically, Egypt has let Israel go. They've said, hey, get out of here. We don't want you guys here anymore. Please leave. And so Israel is now leaving the promise, leaving to go to the promised land. And something interesting is going to happen. God, first of all, he says he doesn't want them to go to the shortest route. So this is in Exodus 13. He says, don't go the shortest route because there are Philistines there. And if you guys see battle, you'll probably give up and go back to Egypt. So he takes them on kind of a roundabout way. But he takes them on this weird detour that goes into the middle of nowhere, and he puts them in a place where they have the Red Sea in front of them, and they have mountains on either side, and the only thing behind them is just desert. And when Pharaoh realizes that, he marches an entire army up to destroy the Israelites. And they're put inside of their first great trial when it comes to getting out. And they fail in a lot of ways, but God delivers them anyway. We'll talk about that more tonight. But what this passage is really showing us is it's showing us the truth of a very famous verse in the New Testament. I'm going to read it to you guys right now. You probably heard it because of how famous it is. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. No temptation has overtaken you except such is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. Very famous verse. Most people can quote that. It's on a lot of mugs, I suppose. It's probably on some cheesy posters with rainbows and whatnot. You know, maybe some bumper stickers. Who knows? But you know, it's an often quoted verse that people really like. And you can see why people would like it, right? And the reason why people like it so much is because they're misquoting it. They misunderstand what the verse is actually saying. Again, it's a very beautiful promise that Paul is giving us, but it's not the promise we think he's giving us. See, when I used to read that verse, or whenever that verse was quoted to me, what people said was, God knows what you're able to handle and will never give you anything that you can't handle. And so when I was growing up, I was like, that's awesome. You know, God will never put me in a trial that I can't handle. And you know what I found? I found that I went through trials all the time where I couldn't handle them. And then they also said to me, like, hey, don't worry, you know, with every temptation, God gives you a way to escape it. So God will never give you any temptation in your life that you can't resist. And once again, I was like, okay, that's awesome. So God will never give a temptation to me that I can't resist. And what I found is that I constantly, consistently gave into sin over and over and over again. And I was like, man, there must be something wrong with me, because God promises that he'll never tempt me above what I'm able, and yet I feel like these temptations are more than what I can handle. So maybe I'm just super weak. You know, maybe I'm just like a mad, weak Christian. And God's like, he's trying to give me like the training wheels, but I'm still falling over on my tricycle. And I guess I just suck like really hard. And I didn't really get it. So instead of this verse giving me comfort and hope, it actually gave me quite a bit of condemnation. And I don't know if it's done that for you guys in your Christian walks. I don't know if it's been helpful or hurtful to you. But what I'm going to help you do through this story, through this little section of scripture from Exodus 13 all the way to 15, what I'm hoping that you guys are going to see through this is what that verse is actually telling us. Now, there is some important things to this verse. The first thing is that God actually does know what you can bear, what you can handle. He does know your limit. Because remember what I said in Exodus 13, and I'll actually read you guys the passage so you guys can kind of see what I'm getting at. But in Exodus chapter 13, remember what I said, God gave them a detour specifically because he knew if they were to go a different way, they wouldn't be able to handle it. And let me read you guys the specific passage so you guys can see this. This is 13, verse 17. It came to pass when Pharaoh had let the people go that God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near, or a more direct route is what some translations say. For God said, lest perhaps the people change their mind when they see war and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. So we do see that God knew that if they were to fight, they would have given up. They wouldn't have been able to handle it. They would have gone back to Egypt. So he does know your limit. But the question is that what does your limit actually mean? And there's actually a really good hint about what this actually means when you get into the word that I used in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, if you guys remember it. I said, God will always give you a way of escape so that you might be able to bear it. And that's the key word there. That word bear, that word endure in some of your translations, it's only used one other time in the entire New Testament by the Apostle Paul. And it's used in a very interesting spot. It's used in 2 Timothy chapter 1, where Paul is talking about his sufferings that he endured during the time that he was preaching in three different cities, Iconium, Lystra, and Antioch. And you could read about this time in Acts chapter 17. And what happens in these times, and he says this in 2 Timothy 1, he says, and during these times you know what trials God had me endure or bear in Antioch, Iconium, and Lystra. And what happened to Paul during those times is he was kicked out of all three cities, but on the third and final city, what they did is the Jews dragged him to the center of the city and they stoned him. They took big heavy rocks and pelted him in the face with them until they assumed he was dead, grabbed him by the feet, dragged him out of town, and left him in the wilderness to rot, basically. And Paul says, you know, he's talking to Timothy, he says, you know all the things that I had to endure. Now let me ask you a question. Does getting stoned seemingly to death seem like something that is easy for someone to handle? Do you think Paul, after he got stoned to death, he was like, man, that was really simple. You know, those rocks, they kind of didn't feel too bad. You know, like they hurt a little, but, you know, I walked it off. You know, had to maybe stretch out. I got a physical therapy massage afterwards. It worked the kinks right out, man. It was all good, dude. You know, like, no, if you get hit in the face with rocks that size, you're going to get in a concussion. You're going to have broken bones. You're going to have, like, internal bleeding. I mean, yeah, the Apostle Paul lived through it and says he walked back into the city, but don't think he walked back into the city looking awesome, you know, like riding a white horse with no wounds on him, and he's like, yeah, dude, that was easy, you know? He was definitely hurting a lot. So that helps us to kind of understand what this word endure actually means. The word endure does not ever carry the idea of ease. Do you guys understand that? It doesn't say that God will give you a way of escape so that you will be able to have ease in whatever you go through. What endurance is endurance is reaching the end of your strength and continuing to persevere. That's what endurance is. And those of you guys who work out, you know exactly what this is, right? If you want to gain anything through working out, you must push yourself beyond what you think you're capable of doing. If you stop exercising at the point where things become difficult, you will never become stronger. And the people in this room that will understand this most are people who do cardio. Now, how many of you guys like run or swim or bike or something like that? Okay, cardio will show you this more than anything. Sorry, Jordan. But cardio will show you this more than anything else. When you do cardio, doesn't matter how much you run, right? In the Marine Corps, I ran every day. And it doesn't matter how many times I ran. Whenever I ran and I pushed myself, I always hit a point where I felt like I couldn't go on. In running circles, we call that hitting the wall, right? You're always going to hit. It doesn't matter if you run marathons on a daily basis. You're going to hit the wall eventually. And what distinguishes good runners, good swimmers, good bicyclists from bad ones is the ability to persevere through that. Do you guys understand what I'm saying? So when God says, I'm going to give you a way out of it so that you can endure it, He's actually not promising you a life of ease. He's actually, ironically, promising you a life of hardship. He's promising you a life of hardship through which you must persevere. That's what he's promising you. And we've been talking about this a lot through the book. False expectations are incredibly damaging to a Christian. If you have false expectations of what trials and temptations are supposed to look like in your life, the only conclusion you're going to come to when real temptations and trials enter into your life is that there's something the matter with me. That's why in 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 7, when Peter is writing to people who are being severely persecuted and are thinking about cashing in their faith because they're having to watch family members being killed, they're having to face the possibility of being crucified, they're having to face the possibility of being eaten alive by wild animals while people cheer for them. You know, they were going through pretty intense amounts of suffering. And Peter writes in 1 Peter 4, verse 7, he says, "Don't think it weird, the fiery trial that's going to test you." As if something odd is happening. He's like, don't think that this is odd. Don't think that you're a special case. Don't think that God is picking on you. Don't think that you've messed up or somehow you've blown it and that's why your life is so difficult. He says, don't think it's weird. It is par for the course. It is absolutely natural to be tempted beyond what you're able to do. It's absolutely natural. In fact, if you're a Christian, you're like, I don't think I've ever been tested to my limits before. That's because you're not trying hard enough. It's not that God hasn't introduced trials into your life. It's because you just haven't been paying attention. For those of you guys who have ever sat in your little worlds and thought, like, I feel like God's picking on me. I feel like I have more trials than anyone else. I feel like I'm constantly tempted beyond what I can bear. You are normal. You guys get that? You're normal. And if you think you're abnormal, that's because we live in a church culture where people are unwilling to admit that. We're willing to admit trials, but we're not willing to admit failure. So, for instance, I would be willing to admit to people that, say, I was being tempted by something. Or I would even be willing to admit to people if I was being tried by something. If I was like, man, you know, my mom died or my dad died or this happened in my life or my girlfriend broke up with me or something like that. I would tell people about that. But when people would ask the question that all Christians do, like, how you doing, brother? I would always respond with, I'm doing good, man. The Lord is good and he's strong in me and I'm trusting in him. But was that true? No, it wasn't true. The truth was that I was being tempted beyond my limit. And I was about this close from giving up. I wanted to give up. So God does know your limit. But he knows your limit better than you know your limit. So you're going to feel like God is testing you beyond what you are able. But in reality, he is testing you exactly what you're able to withstand. He knows exactly what you can withstand before absolutely giving up and going back to the world. So he does know your limit. And be ready for God to show you what that limit is through pain. All right, he's a really good, like I always say, he's like a really good personal trainer. You know, personal trainers, really good ones, they're the ones who actually know your limit. So that when you're like, dude, I can't do anymore, they're like, yeah, you can. And they make you do it. And you're like, man, you know me better than I know myself. They're like, yeah, I know. That's why I'm your trainer. And that's how God is. He knows what you can handle. He knows what you can bear. And he will always bring you to that place. And before you guys think that this is a new invention, I would encourage you guys to read through the Bible and read through the people of the Bible who were tested beyond their limit. And it's all of them. Spoiler alert. It's all of them. Right? All the ones that we have enough information on anyway. You have people in the Bible like King David, right? King David has many psalms. Many psalms. I'm not even talking like isolated, like you could look for one. There are many psalms where David talks about being tested beyond his limit. And one of them, he says, my sins have gone over my head. I don't want to go on. Right? And another psalm, and I like this one. It's one of my favorites. He says, oh, that I had the wings of a dove that I could fly away from my problems and dwell in the wilderness. I'm like, yeah, I get that. You know, I don't know if you guys have ever felt like that. You're like, dude, I wish I could just fly away from my problems and be alone. I felt like that before. Or you got people like Job. You know, I don't have to go through him, but he lost heart a lot. You got people like Jeremiah, lost hope a lot. You have people like Ezekiel, lost hope a lot. Or how about the apostles? You know, you think Jesus is hanging out with the apostles for 3 years. You think that they would be strong, right? Jesus consistently proved how weak the apostles were. You have one instance where they're trying to go across the Sea of Galilee and Jesus causes a giant storm to come and almost swallow them up. And when they're without hope and then they're beyond any hope of being rescued and they're thinking like, we're going to drown for sure, you know what Jesus does? He walks up to the boat on the water, mind you, and he asks them to step out of the boat. They already think they're going to drown in the boat, and Jesus is calling them out of the boat. Isn't that crazy? Jesus constantly calls people beyond what they think they can handle. Because only when you do that will you actually be able to grow in your Christian walk. And that leads me to my next point. This does not mean that you won't lose heart. Exodus 14, verse 10 through 12. So God puts them in this spot, right? He puts them in the spot where there's no way out. They can't go forward, they can't go back, they can't go side, they can't go to the other side. They're trapped in this section. And they don't know what to do. They're like, dude, Pharaoh's going to come, he's going to kill us. And in verse 10, they said, and when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. And they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not what we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness. I don't know if any of you guys have felt like that before with God. We're like, why did you call me out to follow you if you're just going to kill me? You know, like, why would you call me to follow you when this is what following you looks like? Looks like misery. I feel like my life sucks worse than when I was an atheist. I feel like my life is harder than when I didn't believe in you. Forget easier. Forget better. My life was way easier as an atheist. My life was way easier before I knew you. I feel like now that I know you, my life has gotten way, way harder. And once again, if you feel that way, you are amongst great company. In Psalm 73, one of the psalmists, he says, I feel like I have washed my hands in vain, for my life is nothing but agony. There are many people in the Bible that feel that way. They're including the Israelites right here, that when they're in this situation, they feel like God has screwed them over. They're like, dude, why didn't you just let me just... I know you're setting me free and all this stuff, but why didn't you just let me live in bondage? I would rather have lived in bondage than to have lived in this particular situation right here. I prayed almost this exact same prayer at a certain point in my life. I remember I had been a Christian for about 6 months. I'd just come out of atheism. I'd been a Christian for about 6 months. I knew that God was real. I knew that I wanted to serve Him, but I just kept falling to sin. I couldn't stop. I couldn't give up the sin that I was committing. It just kept sinking back into it, and my life just felt so miserable. And I longed for my time without God. I was like, God, I remember being an atheist and just being able to sin, and I was empty, sure, but at least I didn't feel utterly hopeless and filled with guilt and remorse and shame about all the evil actions that I'm doing. And I remember sitting in church, and I prayed to God. I said, God, I love you, but can you please leave me? I would rather be slightly happy in my sin than absolutely destitute in a relationship with you. Right, so this prayer is something that is repeated throughout the Bible, and it's something that I've definitely said in my own life. So that's something that we got to understand. In this walk, in this Christian life, you're going to lose heart. You're going to give up. You're going to get to the end of yourself, and you're going to think like there's no hope. And you will give up. So the idea that 1 Corinthians 10:13 means that we're never going to get to a place where we feel like giving up is false. You will absolutely go to the place where you feel like giving up. The key is that God gets you to the place where you feel like giving up, but you actually won't. Where you feel like giving in, but you actually won't give in. And He will give you the exact amount of grace in that moment to get through whatever it is you're going through. And I'll just share a little bit from what happened to me. So when I prayed that to God, I remember His response to me very vividly. It's probably one of the only times I felt like God audibly spoke to me, and it was really cool. And it was just a quotation. It was a biblical quotation, and I'm The reason why I'm positive that it was God speaking to me is because at this time I wasn't really reading my Bible, and so I didn't know any Bible passages. And what I heard was, where iniquities abound, grace abounds much more. And it actually took me years to figure out where that was in the Bible. I'd never heard that before. I thought I just kind of made it up. But it's in Romans chapter 5, verse 19, where iniquities abound, grace abounds much more. And that verse, what I heard when God spoke that to me, was exactly what I needed to hear in the moment. Because the real reason why I wanted to give up was because I felt like God had already given up on me. I felt like I was kind of wasting God's time. I felt like God was sick of me. I thought he was sick of forgiving me. He was sick of spending time with me. And he just wanted to leave me anyway. And I was just kind of giving him an out. I was like, yeah, you could leave me if you want. And hearing that verse in my head, in my heart, in that moment, was the first time I'd ever audibly heard God tell me that he cared about me, that he loved me. And in that moment, I knew that God loved me. I knew he cared about me. And I knew that no matter how far I fell, no matter how far away from him I went, he would never stop loving me and he would never stop trying to save me. And that's what I needed to keep going. I needed that to keep going. I wasn't set free from my sin in that moment, but it gave me enough hope. It gave me enough strength to keep fighting my sin and to not give up, to not give in, to bear, to endure through my suffering. And I'm going to add this really quickly, just so you guys understand this. That doesn't mean that everybody who is a Christian stays a Christian. Some people leave the Christian faith because of trial. They really do. What this verse is saying, and I don't know those people. I'm not in their hearts. I'm not in their heads. I don't know what they're going through. I don't know what they're experiencing. But what this verse is saying is that God gives everybody the chance to persevere through what they're going through. So if somebody gives in their faith, if somebody leaves God, it's because they didn't take God up on his offer. They didn't want to endure anymore. They gave up. It's like, again, when a runner is going for it and they hit the wall, it's easier to just stop running when you feel that way. It's much harder to keep running anyway. And a good example in this is when we get to the book of Numbers, we're going to see the Israelites hit the wall and give up. Right, they get into a similar situation where they get into a situation where they know they have to take the land. They know they have to fight these people that are in Canaan. And they know that these people are far more powerful than them. So they're afraid. They're like, God, if we go in there, we're going to get wiped out. We're going to get slaughtered. There's no way we can make it. And they totally give up. They say, God, I don't care what you say. We're going back to Egypt. And so God allows them to die because of that. Because that lapse of faith. So not everybody takes God up on his offer of strength. Not everybody takes God up on his offer to endure. But know this, if you take God up on his offer to endure, things won't get easier, things will get more intense. All that God is promising you is that endurance is building something that's worth something. And that God is worth it. And we'll talk more about that later. But that leads me to my next point, and that is, why does God make us endure anything? If he's a loving father, why does he make you go through anything? Why doesn't he make your life super easy? Right? Why isn't it like right when you give your life to God, he just fills your bank account with millions of dollars, he cures all your ills, he makes all your sins just go away where you're not even tempted anymore, and you become a perfect person overnight? I mean, why doesn't God make it easy? Why does he have to make it difficult? And, you know, a lot of the answers that I got when I was younger just never really sat well with me. I was like, that's kind of crap. Because people would be like, well, you know, God can't do that because of blah, blah, blah. And they would give me these weird answers like, well, you know, he's trying to sanctify you and he's trying to make you a better person and he's trying to do this and he's trying to do that. And I was like, but when we go to heaven, isn't that exactly what he's going to do? Right? When we go to heaven, isn't he going to cleanse me of sin? Isn't he going to cure me of all my ills? Isn't he going to make my life super easy? So why can't he just do that now? Right? God, don't wait till heaven. Just do it now, and then I'll serve you until heaven. Right? That was the way I thought. That was the way I understood things. So I just, those answers didn't make me happy. Those answers just made me more frustrated with God. I was like, God, what the heck gives, man? You know, if you're going to do it later, just do it now. Just do this now. Make my life easy now. Don't make me go through this trial. Don't make me go through this suffering for no reason. But what I didn't understand then, and that I do understand now, is that there actually is a very good reason of which God makes us go through what he makes us go through. And it's because I didn't really understand sin. I didn't really get it. I didn't understand the sin in my own heart. I didn't understand exactly what was making me sin, what was causing me to go away from God. And it had nothing to do with cravings. Meaning, I used to think that my struggle with sin was just all about sexual morality or pornography or lying or drugs or alcohol. That's how I identified sin. But what God revealed to me over time is my major issue is simply this. I don't trust God. That's the issue. That's my issue. And you could take it all the way back to the book of Genesis and see that that has been the issue of mankind since day one. The fall of the Garden of Eden, that's what it was all about. Right? God planted this one tree in the middle of the garden. He says, don't eat that tree. You could have any other tree, just don't eat that tree. And Satan came up to Adam and Eve and he says, did God really say that this tree is going to kill you? He says, I'll tell you this, if you eat of that tree, you're going to be like God. And you will discern what is good and evil for yourself. What's Satan's temptation? God is holding out on you. God is not being honest with you. God, there is something better than God out there. And he is keeping it from you. He's not letting you have it. God's mean. That was a temptation. And ever since that day, that seed of doubt has been planted in all of our minds and in all of our hearts. And deep down, you believe it. To some level, you believe it. And that is the source of all of your problems. And God must cure you of that illusion. And he's got to do that to me too. I don't trust God. I don't believe God. I don't think he has what's right for me. And if he were to just take away all temptation in my life, deep down in my heart, I would be angry about that. I would be like, God took away that temptation because he knows it would have actually satisfied me. God doesn't want me to go to sexual immorality because sexual immorality would be so much fun. And God's just a big old jerk in the sky and he's keeping that away from me. You know, God says no to drugs because drugs would actually give me what I'm looking for. God says no to this because it would actually satisfy my soul. Why does God say no? That's so mean of him, right? Deep down in my life, I'm just that rebellious kid who just wants his way. And the only way, right, the only way for God to show you the damage of sin is to let you reap the fruit of sin. That's the only way it's going to work. What did the Israelites want to do? They wanted to go back where? To Egypt. You guys got to remember, these people grew up in Egypt. They'd been there for 400 years. That's all they knew. They didn't want to go to Canaan. They had no concept of Canaan. They didn't know what it looked like. They only knew Egypt. They're like, this is our home. We don't want to leave. And so God had to show them how bad Egypt was. And how did he do that? By allowing Egypt to chase them down and try to kill them. And they're like, maybe Egypt wasn't that great. You know, maybe it wasn't that great if these people just wanted us dead in the first place. It kind of is starting to show them the horridness of Egypt. God has to do that with you as well. Yeah, when I came to God, I knew that my sin was empty, but I really didn't. I really didn't. And I know that because all the time, almost on a weekly at best basis, I fall into the same temptation where I'll be clicking around on a computer and I'll have this temptation, I'll have this craving to go to porn, to look at something that I know is not right. And when I'm having that temptation, the lie that's existing in my heart is that this will satisfy you. And I'm starting to go after it because I actually believe that. There's a part of me that really believes it. And God's got to show me that that's not true. He's got to let me taste the rottenness of my sin. He's got to allow consequences to start raining down in my life so I can start realizing that, man, this sin is not what I thought it was. It didn't give me the pleasure that I thought it was going to give me, and it certainly didn't give me the freedom I thought it was going to give me. It gave me nothing but darkness and pain. And it forces you to cry out for something better. So God allows this to enter into your life so that you can learn from it. So you can learn from it. Now, it doesn't mean, by the way, I hope you guys are not getting this from what I'm saying, it doesn't mean that don't worry about it, give in to temptation, because through giving in to temptation, you're going to realize that God's better. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying you need to try your hardest to resist temptation, but if you ignore God and you go after temptation, you're going to realize why He told you not to do it in the first place. He is not shy about allowing consequences to rain down on His children. God is not an enabler. You guys know what that is? An enabler is someone who takes away natural consequences because they don't want people to feel bad. God is not an enabler. God will allow you to suffer to realize exactly why you need Him in the first place. And He is curing you and me of our illusions that we don't need Him. But what about trials? Why is God allowing trials in your life? Because that's temptation, right? But trials are different. And trials are a very difficult thing to talk about. And this is why. It's one thing for me to look at you guys and say, this is why God has left certain temptations in your life. This is why God just doesn't take away your cravings for lust. This is why God doesn't take away your cravings for selfishness, pride, envy, vanity, whatever it is that you struggle with. This is why God hasn't taken those away, and I could explain that to you. But trials are a different thing. Right? You can't look at your life and be like, okay, so God left pain in my life. God allowed my mom to die to, what, teach me a lesson? And I hate it when Christians say that because it's just not true. And I hope you guys never say that to somebody. I hope if someone loses a loved one, you don't go to that person's funeral and say, God did this to you to teach you a lesson. He's disciplining you. Don't say that. Because there is a truth in that, but it's an insufficient truth. It's not real. It's not the whole truth. And it's certainly not helpful in the moment. Because you'd be like, why did God have to take this away from me to teach me a lesson? That's crap. There was no other way to teach me this lesson? Let me break this down. Every trial is different, first off. I can't give you guys a generic answer to why God allows certain things to happen in your life. I just can't. Because there's a different reason for everything. But what I can do is I could take you through one example in the Bible, and through this example, I'm hoping you guys can start applying these things to your life and understanding your own trials. This is the example I'm going to give you guys. It's a guy named Joseph. And Joseph, he had 11 older brothers. Right? He was one of the younger ones. He was the second youngest, actually. So he had 10 older brothers, one younger. And Joseph was the favorite. Isaac favored Joseph his whole life. And because Isaac favored Joseph, his brothers began to resent and hate Joseph with all their being. And it began to poison that family unit, where the brothers despised Joseph and they began to despise their father for favoring Joseph. They felt abandoned. They felt like their dad didn't care or love them. Because it's not that Jacob didn't love them, it's that he loved Joseph more. And sometimes that hurts more than someone just completely ignoring you, doesn't it? I mean, how can you get rid of those feelings of inadequacy and insecurity when you see someone love another person in your life more than they love you, when you desperately need and want that love? And Joseph, what it was doing to him is it started to build up an arrogance in his life where he became a spoiled guy, a spoiled brat. And we know that this happened because Joseph started having dreams, dreams that he would rule over his brothers one day. And we do know that when you look in hindsight in the story, you know that these were prophetic dreams. But Joseph didn't know that. Joseph just marched up to his brothers. And you know what he did? Hey, guys, I had a dream last night that you bowed down and worshiped me. Later, you know, and he like walked away and they're like, that little, you know, like that little punk, man, I'm going to kill him, you know. And then it says that he had a dream just like it again. And you know what he did? Even though he knew telling him that dream pissed him off, you know what he did? He told him again. And he's like, guys, you won't believe it. This time I had a dream that not only did you bow down and worship me, but so did mom and dad. It was awesome. All right, later. You know, and he took off and they're just like, oh, that guy. You know, so you see that he's becoming just this dude who cares nothing about what his actions are doing to other people. He's arrogant. He's selfish. Do you guys see that? He's spoiled. All this stuff is going on in them. And what God ends up doing is he presents a situation where Joseph is put into slavery. His brothers end up betraying him. They throw him in a pit. They strip his cloak off, right? You guys know the story. He had a cloak of many colors. They strip that cloak off. They fake his death. They sell him into slavery in Egypt. And Joseph goes through a pretty horrific couple years of his life where he goes from being a slave to a prisoner, down in the depths thinking that he's going to die. And then after that, God presents a situation in which Joseph gets raised up as being a leader, a powerful leader in Egypt. And because he's in that position of power, he actually is able to enact a plan through God giving him prophetic dreams that ends up saving all of the Middle East. Because Joseph foresaw a coming famine, and he was able to store up food and save all the Middle East, including his family, from death. And you look at that and you're like, well, why didn't God just, you know, like come down and say, Joseph, you're spoiled. Stop it. Jacob, you're being a bad father. Quit it, man. You need to love all your sons equally. Other sons, you're murderous, you're jacked up, fix yourself, and then leave. You're like, why didn't God do that? You know why God didn't do that? Because nobody can be told what their sin is. Nobody can be told what their sin is. You know what happens when you tell a spoiled person that they're spoiled? They'll be like, says you. I'm not spoiled. You're spoiled. What about you, man? And they'll point the finger right back at you. You know what happens when you tell a murderous person that they're being murderous and bitter and resentful? They'd be like, well, you don't know what I've been through. You don't know what that little punk has put me through. Man, if you were in my situation, you would be feeling the same thing. You know what happens when you tell a parent who's favoring one child over others that they're being a bad parent? They'd be like, well, who are you to tell me that I'm a bad parent? I'm a good parent. I love all my kids equally. You don't know what I do. You don't know what I go through. Joseph is just a little bit better than the other people, so I give him a little more responsibility. But who are you to tell me that I'm being favoritism and all that stuff? You don't know what a bad parent is. You're a bad parent. You can't tell people that stuff. Do you guys get that? You just can't. And if you don't believe what I'm saying, try it. Try it. If you know someone spoiled in your life, tell them that they're spoiled. Tell them that they need to fix themselves. See what they do. If you know someone who's bitter and resentful and they're not forgiving, tell them that they're bitter and resentful and not forgiving. See what they do. They will not listen to you. I guarantee it. The only way for someone to realize what's going on in their life is not to be told, but it is to be shown. It is to be shown. So one of the reasons why God allows severe trial inside of your life is to show you a truth that you would not see otherwise. And it may be a painful truth, it may be a horrible truth, but it's to show you a truth that you may not see any other way. C.S. Lewis, he wrote the book A Grief Observed, which is, by the way, my favorite book that in existence, next to the Bible. It is an incredibly good book, and I cannot recommend it more. He wrote this book as a journal after his wife died. It's very short, and it's very, very, very powerful. And it's very heart-wrenching as well. And in the journal, he goes up and down. At some points, in some chapters, he's accusing God of being a murderer. In some chapters, he's accusing God of abandoning him. In some chapters, he's saying, like, I'm getting over it. God is helping me. Right? It's very raw. It's very real about what someone goes through when they go through that amount of loss, because it's exactly what he went through. And one of the chapters, he writes something incredibly profound. He says, I would have never known that my faith was nothing but a house of cards until God blew on it. He always thought he had an incredible faith with the Lord. C.S. Lewis is one of the top apologists to have ever lived. His books have influenced probably more people in the last century than any other author has. Right? When people talk about C.S. Lewis, they talk about him in the same realm as people like the early church fathers, St. Augustine, Ignatius, people like that, people that you guys probably don't know about anymore. But, you know, he was one of the greatest thinkers of our generation, and he lost faith in God. He stopped believing that God was good in the midst of trial. And C.S. Lewis said, I mean, what an incredibly selfish thing to do. He says, it's not that I knew that people didn't lose spouses on a daily basis. It's not that I knew that incredible tragedy couldn't befall me. It's that when it touched my life, my selfishness enlarged, and I realized that I didn't really trust God. I trusted in myself. That was something that C.S. Lewis had to be shown. You couldn't have told him that. It was something he had to see for himself. And it took that trial to demonstrate that to him. But like I said, that's an insufficient answer in and of itself. There's more to the answer. For Joseph, it wasn't just to show him that he was a spoiled brat. There was other things that God was doing. The salvation of the entire world was dependent on Joseph going into slavery. And this is the next point. You will never know exactly why God has you in the trial that He has you in. You will never know. Maybe at the end of your life, you will begin to understand some of the things that God is doing in the trials that you're going through, but you will never know because God is above and beyond all things. You got to have a perspective that's beyond yourself. You can't see it. One poet put it pretty eloquently. He says, if you really are a masterpiece, if you really are a masterpiece, will you really critique an orchestrator or someone who writes a symphony on a single note of their masterpiece? What he means is if you took something like Clair de Lune, which is one of my favorite orchestral masterpieces, it's a fantastic song, and Clair de Lune, if you just took one note of Clair de Lune and you examined it and you're like, where the heck is this? Where's this guy going with this? This sounds stupid. I don't get it. This is dumb, right? And you just critiqued that one note, you would never understand the fullness of what he's trying to do. Whatever trial's going on in your life, you have to remember something. You're immortal. You're an eternal being. No matter how long a trial is existing inside of your life, in the grand scheme of things, it is a single note in the midst of a symphony. And for you to critique God on this single note is because you don't know the whole picture. You got to trust Him with the whole picture. Your masterpiece, your symphony, whatever you're going through, no matter how big it is still in the grand scheme of things just a singular note. It's not what you think it is. And you got to trust God with the whole picture. You have to. You don't have a choice. That was the whole point of the book of Job. Job goes through this terrible, terrible tragedy in his life. He loses everything. And you know what God tells him? He gives him a 4-chapter monologue about how Job will never understand the workings of the universe. He's like, Job, did you build the earth? Because I kind of did. Right? Did you make all of humanity? Do you judge in righteousness? And then he goes into a two-chapter description of these two giant creatures, the behemoth and the leviathan. And he's like, these creatures are massive and they're big. Job, can you even comprehend them? Have you even seen them? Do you even know what they can do? And God says, and yet these creatures are a part of my good creation. And any of us would look at that and be like, how could some massive creature of death possibly be a part of God's good creation? And God says, you'll never understand. You'll never understand, but I do. You got to trust me. God never tells Job why he's going through what he's going through. Not because he didn't want to, but because he knew that Job would never understand it. If God were to come down and tell you exactly why you're going through what you're going through, you would never be able to comprehend it. Because God's not just thinking about your life. He's thinking about all of creation. And everything is being influenced. All of the world is being influenced by your life, whether you realize it or not. Your life has impact that you can't possibly fathom. And the trials that you're going through are building something that you can't possibly understand. You got to trust God. That's the why of God moving inside of our life. I'm going to read you guys a chapter from a little passage from a woman named Joni Erickson Tada. I don't know if you guys have heard of her. She's a pretty famous Christian. She writes a lot. She does a lot of things on the radio. She's a woman who wasn't born this way, but she became a quadriplegic, meaning that she only has feeling from the neck down. She can't move her hands or arms or legs or anything like that. She's in a wheelchair. She has chronic pain, and she survived breast cancer. So she's had quite a bit of trials in her life. And this is what she says to God. Thank you, I whispered. Thank you for the healing you gave me. The deeper healing, O God, you were so wise not to give me a physical healing because that no meant yes to a stronger faith in you, a deeper prayer life, and a greater understanding of your word. It has purged sin from my life, forced me to depend on your grace and increase my compassion for others who hurt. It has stretched my hope, given me a lively, buoyant trust in you, stirred an excitement about heaven and pushed me to give thanks in times of sorrow. It has increased my faith and helped me to love you so much more. Jesus, I love you more. He didn't give me the physical healing I had wanted, but the deeper healing that I needed. God invites us all to experience this deeper healing, this miracle of a changed heart rather than changed circumstances. This healing that strengthens our prayer life, increases our faith, and helps us love Jesus more. This healing that is not shallow or fleeting, it will last throughout all of eternity, for grace always heals deeper. And that's a pretty impressive prayer from someone who goes through that amount of suffering and saying, like, I'm happy that God put me through this. And the little piece that she's holding on to is she's saying, I don't understand exactly why God's doing this, but this is what I do understand. Through my suffering, it has taught me to learn to trust God. This is something else that is true about your pride. You will never trust God until you are put in a position where you have to trust God. We are deeply self-reliant, whether we realize it or not. And you will always try to fix yourself until you get to the place where you realize you can't. So yes, God will put you through horrific things, but he will do it in order to teach you that he is the only rock worth trusting in. He realizes that unless he breaks you of this illusion of trusting in yourself, you're going to live a life of misery, always trying to be good enough on your own strength, and always trying to heal yourself in your own will. But when you realize just how weak you are, you can finally rely on the strength of God and find what it means to find peace. Paul realized this. In 2 Corinthians 12, he had an affliction that was so severe, he said he prayed 3 times that God would remove it from him. And God responds to him and he says, my grace is sufficient for you, for in your weakness my strength is made perfect. And Paul, learning from this prayer, learning from what God responded to him, he writes, therefore, I boast in my infirmities and in my weaknesses. I boast in all of my trials and my agonies, for I know that when I am weak, then Christ has the power to be strong. If you want the deeper love and fellowship and intimacy with God that is going to change your life in ways that you can't even understand, you got to go through some fire. It's not acquired painlessly. So God knows what he's doing. The final thing that I'll mention to you guys, in Exodus 15, they write a song to God, which is cool because it shows that they actually learn from this. Without this, all you're going to do is praise yourself. But because of what God put them through, they realize that all of my salvation is from God. And that's why they say this, the Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. He is my God and I will praise him. The people of Israel never said anything like that until God delivered them from this trial. To see God as your salvation, not as a means to a better life, or a means to a greater joy, or a means to a deeper intimacy, or a better marriage, or a greater career path. If you want to see God as your salvation, you got to be put through trials like what the people of Israel were put through. But that doesn't mean that you won't have bitterness. Because at the end of this chapter, what happens is right after the salvation, they go through the desert and they realize we don't have any water. And they find a pool. They find a pool and they try to drink from it. And the water is bitter. And they name the water Marah. If any of you guys have friends that are named Mary, my mom's name is Mary, that word actually means bitterness, which is kind of sad. But that's what that word means. It means bitterness. And they name it bitterness because of the way the water tasted. And what God tells them to do is really interesting. He says, cut down a tree and throw it in the water. And when they do this, the water is healed and the bitterness goes away. And God says to them in verse 26, if you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all of his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. I know I've gone through this tonight with you guys, but man, to not develop a bitterness over your life and a bitterness towards God is almost impossible. And God gives us the answer right here of how to deliver you from bitterness. A bitterness towards what you've gone through, a bitterness towards what God has made you go through, a life with a chip on your shoulder where you feel resentful towards everybody around you. God gives you the exact answer of how to not do that. Right? Because a lot of people that go through a lot of trials, they end up becoming pretty bitter people. You guys haven't noticed. But God says that something can happen that could actually turn bitter waters into sweet water. And it takes them putting a tree inside of this water to do it. It's very interesting in the New Testament that it says that Jesus was hung on a tree. And when you read that, you're like, isn't that a bit of an exaggeration? I mean, it's kind of like a couple boards. I guess it was a part of a tree, but I don't know if it was like an actual tree. It's not like they put him on an actual tree. That's kind of weird. The reason why there's a couple reasons why they say that, but this is one of them. I don't know if you guys knew that. This is one of them. What they're saying is that when the cross enters into the waters of your life, it could actually cure you of your bitterness. It could heal you of your bitterness. And there's a couple ways that it does it. Number one, having a Lord and Savior that puts you through trials can only be made sweet if that same Lord and Savior has been through the same trials you've been through. How could you not grow bitter at God that makes you go through things that He Himself is not willing to go through? Those of you guys who have jobs, you know that exact kind of bitterness that I'm talking about. Don't you hate it when a boss tells you to do something that you know he would never do himself? Doesn't that just breed bitterness in your heart? You're like, that lazy piece of crap would never do this, and here I am doing it. That piece of, you know, and like it just breeds bitterness in your heart. The only way that you can go through what you're about to go through is to know for a fact that God went through it first. Jesus, the only one who never had to endure pain, endured absolute pain on your behalf. He was stripped naked, beaten to almost death, and had nails driven through his wrists as people mocked him and laughed at him as he bled out. Jesus knows what you're going through. Jesus knows what it's like to have a life that is not in nobility. Jesus was born in the ghetto to a father who was a carpenter, which in that day, I mean, a lot of historians equate carpentry to slavery, right? He wasn't exactly living on the high horse. He knows what it's like to be looked over. He knows what it's like to be cast aside. He knows what it's like to be abused. He knows what it's like to be hurt. He knows what it's like to be mocked. He knows what it's like to have a family hate him. No matter what you go through, no matter what you've been through, God knew it first. And knowing that is going to help you with your bitterness. The other way that the cross helps make sweet what is bitter, is because the greatest injustice and suffering that has ever taken place inside of humanity was the unrighteous suffering of the Son of God on the cross. No matter what suffering I go through in my life, I deserve worse. Now, that truth doesn't make it easier for me to go through suffering, but that is the truth. No matter what suffering I go through on this earth, I deserve worse because of the sin that I have committed. Jesus was the only one who was sinless, the only one who deserved a perfect life, and instead he had one of the most horrific lives that anyone could ever live and ended in the most horrific ways that anyone's life could have ever ended in. And when you let that sink in, what you understand is if God could take the greatest tragedy that has ever befallen humanity and turn it into the salvation of all mankind, he can certainly take whatever suffering I'm going through and transform it into the sweetest of waters. So it's not that you'll see it in the moment, but it's that you have a reason to trust it in the moment. There's a poem written by a guy named George Herbert, and he talks about Joseph Coe. It's called Joseph's Coe, and this is what he writes. He says, "Wounded I sing, tormented I compose, thrown down I fall into a bed and rest. Sorrow has changed its note, such is his will. Who changes all things as him pleases best? For well he knows, if but one grief and wound among my many had its full career, sure it would carry with it even my heart. And both would run until they found a coffin to fetch the body, both being due to grief. But he hath spoiled the race and given to anguish one of joy's coats, ticing it with relief to linger in me and together languish. I live to show his power, who once did bring my joys to weep, and now brings my griefs to sing." I'm going to pull out a couple things of this passage. The first one is that he talks about being wounded and still singing praises to God, and the way that he's able to do it, and the whole purpose of this, by the way, is he says that knowing joy's coat enables you to go through any suffering and sing through it. And what joy's coat is, I don't have time to get into it too deeply, but this is what it is. Joy's coat refers to Joseph's coat. And Joseph's coat was his sign from his father that he was absolutely adored and loved beyond all others. What George Herbert is saying is if you want to go through suffering and not grow bitter and weak and give up, you have to be clothed with the knowledge that God absolutely loves you. That He absolutely loves and adores you and favors you above all else. And the way you get that coat is by studying what He went through for you. Remember what I said, Mara means bitterness? You remember what Jesus' mother's name was? It was Mary. There's a reason why Mary, bitterness, gave birth to the Savior of the entire world. It's because through the bitterness that our Savior suffers, you have assurance that you're loved. And the more you study that and the more you believe it, the more you're going to be able to go through whatever you're going through and still find the ability to rejoice. And as that heals your heart, you will be deeper in your relationship with God and you will be further in freedom from whatever you're going through. Let's pray. Dear God, I want to thank you so much for this truth. I pray that whatever temptations or trials are going on in our life, I pray that you would help us to remember the coat of your love, God, to remember that you care for us deeper than anyone else. Help us to believe that even when our emotions are saying otherwise, and help us to trust you. Help us to take our situations that we're going through, our anxieties, our fears, our doubts, our angers, and help us to pray them to you and to give them to you and trust you with our lives. We're very thankful for you, God, and in your name, amen.